Booyah!
Storage.
Lungs suck.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 144. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, sir?
Doing good. I'm doing good. It's kind of a cloudy day, but I'm trying to look on the brighter side of things. I'm cleaning out my office, cleaning out the lab, trying to, you know, get some cabling in order.
Oh, yeah? You're in your lab?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the side of my office desk where some, you know, gear is, but
nice. Yeah. I've seen your nooks, man. You got like nine nooks just laying all over your desk. Setup whatsoever. They're just like, some are under the desk, some are over the desk.
I'm actually trying to upgrade things. I've got a Raspberry Pi 4 here. I'm trying to mix it up a little bit. You know, now that winter's over, I no longer need to heat my office. So I'm paying a little more attention to the thermals.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. I've been in my lab all day too, but my lab is a lab that's online. It's a Nimbus lab, which is, everything. I feel a little spoiled when we talk about that because I don't have to manage a kit at my actual house. I get everything done just by clicking a couple of buttons in Jenkins and boom, I have a lab. But not everybody has that. So I was talking to a good friend of ours, Mr. William Lamb, who's got, you know, he's one of the kings of home labs, in my opinion. And he's actually aggregating a list of all the different home labs that are out there in the IT community. And I thought it would be a good time to bring him on, as well as some other guys that have home labs, and just talk about home labs, you know, see what people are doing, what they're installing, why they use it, how they're using it. Maybe we can all learn some tips. What do you think, John?
Sounds like a productive discussion.
Sweet. All right. Well, let's bring on our panel of experts, starting with Mr. William Lamb. William, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Hey. Also joining us is Max Abelardo. Max is from VMware, and he's got an amazing lab I want to talk to him about. Max, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you, John.
And last but not least, no stranger to the podcast, our good friend from ITQ, Mr. Johan van Amersfoort. Johan, what's up, buddy?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
How's everything going over there?
Good. I'm in Romania preparing for the actual FEMUG in Romania tomorrow in Bucharest.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, you and Niels, right?
Yeah. Niels Hagert is here as well. We're going to talk about GPUs and all sorts of awesome stuff that's happening at the moment.
I like it. All right. So like I was saying, the impetus of this conversation started when William shared with me this list that he was aggregating on home labs, because I was curious. Like, I don't have a home lab, as I mentioned. And I was kind of curious if I wanted to set up a home lab in my house, A, how much would it cost? And B, what are some of the setups? You know, if I'm going to install vSAN, what are some of the configurations I need to consider? What's available to me in terms of licensing? And so there's a lot of different aspects when it comes to home labs. So maybe, William, you can start off by telling us a little bit about this list that you started.
Yeah, no, those are all great questions. And in fact, those are things that I actually get on a weekly basis, several dozen times, actually. And it can actually be really difficult to get started initially, right? Because there's just so many different configurations. There's no right or wrong in terms of what dictates a home lab. I think for some people, they want to just get started, maybe get their VCP certification. So they want to kind of enter in the market, getting a small setup, maybe like an Intel NUC, running a handful of virtual machines, just kind of get familiar with vSphere. We have other folks who are deploying, you know, the full SCD stack, obviously vSAN, NSX, and vRealize, and you probably need a little bit more than just an Intel NUC or maybe several of them. And what I found over the years is that I get a lot of inquiries on how to get started, what are some of the available hardware configuration, because obviously every year things are changing. We've seen a lot of new innovations from Intel, especially on the NUC platforms, and they're providing a variety of setups.
Yeah.
And then what can I do? What can I run on them? And all of those frequently asked questions. And rather than being the bottleneck or holder of all this knowledge, you know, I figured that this would be a really good opportunity to kind of involve the community and kind of crowdsource some of this information. I've seen over the years some amazing home lab setups.
Yeah.
You know, folks from Eric, Max, and Johan from on the panel itself. But there's a lot of other folks who've done some really innovative things, you know, including building their own like Pelican heavy duty artillery cases. You know, it's just amazing, right? And so rather than folks having to go online and try to find information, sometimes it might be out of date, why not try to crowdsource that from our community?
Yeah, because there are so many different setups. I mean, like, I know for a long time you were a Mac Mini guy, right?
Yeah. I was a Mac Mini guy for some time. A lot of it was kind of driven from a lot of our customers, and then started to switch over to the Intel Nooks and then a little bit of Supermicro. So even my usage of home labs, you know, it used to be pretty crazy. I've kind of tamed down a little bit since it's sitting right next to me in my home office.
Yeah.
So this list was really to kind of crowdsource. And, you know, I think it's been out about a couple of weeks now, and we have about almost 50 submissions. And what I wanted to do was, you know, have folks submit, but then also make this available to everybody. And the idea was that anybody can submit their home lab, you know, could be recent or it could be from 10 years ago, and basically put together a build of materials, what they use, cost of the hardware, any kind of detail write-up, some of the products, workloads that they've ran. Very simple. And then I would just process the results. And so I just processed the results this morning. So you guys are literally looking at the results for the very first time.
Yeah.
And like I said, we have about 50 submissions, and just the range, you know, if we just talk about pricing for a second, I know that's always on top of mind for a lot of people.
Oh yeah. Yeah. My wife would not let me spend that much money on a lab. So that would be my first question. Like, all right, what is the range? How much can I get away with without getting, you know, without going to the doghouse, if you will.
So based on these 48 submissions so far, let's start with the low end of the range, right? It's coming in about $800. And I'm actually proud to say that's actually my original home lab.
Nice.
This was an Intel Nook that I had serviced me many, many years. Actually, recently just failed. And actually, the system's still fine, but one of the SSDs just kind of borked on me. So I haven't fixed that just yet. On the higher end of the spectrum of the labs, we've got a submission by Mark Hubbard, and the lab is about $150,000.
Oh my goodness. You gotta be kidding me. Like, that's insane. That's $150,000. That's, do you think he really paid that much, or is that just like the value?
You know, I haven't read through the details. I think some of it was out of his own pockets. You know, maybe some of it might've been donated, or maybe it's been price-wise, it's gone down. But I think he actually did pay for most of that. And I think ultimately this goes down to a personal investment. I don't think any of us can normally afford like a production data center for their home lab. But I think, you know, the amount of money that you put into it, there is a return on investment, not only on growth for yourself, your career. And so I think when people think about cost, they're kind of just thinking about that initial CapEx aspect of it, just like when you buy hardware, right? And I think there's a longer value when you start to look at some of the things that you can do with having a home lab.
Well, one trend I'll notice on some of the larger outliers is talking to some of these guys, since, you know, it is that time of the year where we're all thinking about taxes. I suspect some of these were done, there's a higher tilt towards the more expensive labs on people who are independent consultants or things like that, or, you know, they might have a private business that they can write that off as a business expense.
Yeah.
And that, so
I'm not,
you know, telling the IRS, hey, go out and audit all these VMware home labbers or something. And I know actually in the US, the tax code has changed, but in some places overseas, it's still different. You know, obviously some stuff may be deprecated equipment. I've seen people get, you know, 50 grand worth of, I had a giant box of SSDs I was just kind of giving away for a while there that was from a data center that was shut down in a company that closed years ago. But there are also cases where hardware, there may be some tax incentives around explaining some of these outliers, and particularly people who are doing that consulting type stuff.
All right. Well, so I want to learn a little bit more about the labs that we have on the call, and then a little bit more about this list and some of the use cases and stuff like that. So why don't we start with you, Max? Like, your lab looks pretty shiny. Like, it's not only, I can't wait to hear what you're actually doing with it, but just the visual of it is actually really appealing. So tell us a little bit about your lab and what you do with it.
Yeah. Thanks, Pete. It's actually sitting right behind me, sitting right there.
It's like lighting up. Wait, is that noise sensitive? If I yell, does it blink more?
No, it doesn't blink. It's not RGB with your voice. I could maybe hook that up. I worked for a hardware company, and I probably had, you know, equal to that cost of Mark Hubbard's lab, you know, in my data center, in my basement. I actually still have a rack, but when I left that hardware company, I gave all the equipment away, and I was thinking, I work for a software company now. I don't need all this stuff. It's like, well, software still needs hardware to run on.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, despite the fact that we were pretty lucky as VMware employees to have access to, you know, some sandboxes and labs, there's some things that you need to do that maybe needs to persist a little bit longer than, you know, the guys that maintain that lab will let you do. So, and you know what? Well, the problem is having an expensive running lab and then having the energy bills go down to nothing, that's when you get in trouble with the wife. Because then she realized, okay, wow, I didn't realize it was costing $400 a month. And, you know, we were always getting these notices from the energy company saying, you know, we noticed that you're like three times higher than anyone else, even in your vicinity. What are you growing in your basement? Can we assess and give you an audit? So we were finally off that list. And that's when I was like, okay, I need a lab. And she's like, well, we don't want to go back to that. So I put together this lab because, you know, I'm one of those knuckleheads that still runs my own mail server and domain controller and DNS, just to kind of, you know, I've been at IT for about 12 years and I got to stay connected with my customers. And, you know, this is my way of doing it. And I needed something energy efficient. And I came up with this idea with a fellow AE of mine who actually funded half of it. We're still trying to figure out how we separate the assets because I got time into it. He's got some cash. He's a pretty cool guy. So he actually doesn't even work for VMware anymore. But, you know, it was a great way for him to learn the technology that we're selling, you know, because it's all running vSAN, of course. And I can keep it on my desk. You know, whenever I need to do something, I just fire it up really quick. Like you said, you know, Pete, I access hands-on labs when I need to. Yeah. I do the sandbox, but this is just kind of like that go-to. I know it's going to be there no matter what I do.
So what is it? What do you have back there? What are they? NUCs? What do you have?
Yeah, so it's a 4 7th generation NUCs. And they're i5 BNHs, the ones that are a little bit taller. So they have a little bit more, you know, capacity that you can put a hard drive. You can put an M.2 SSD for the cache. And I boot the things off of basically a USB, like a 16 gig USB. So that way I've got ESX on something. I've got the cache. And, you know, I got a whole bunch of SSDs as well. So I've got, I think, a 1.92 terabyte SSDs in each one. So it's more than enough capacity. And I've got an eGPU breakout box too, because I was like, Johan, you get some stuff from Intel or from NVIDIA. It's like, hey, I got to find a way to use this. So I do a lot of these demos, you know, and I do some machine learning and some, you know, AI stuff. And to put that on a NUC, it challenges the NUC quite a bit.
Oh, I bet, so, yeah.
That eGPU breakout box with the Thunderbolt, it's amazing. I mean, you can do all kinds of things. So I actually submitted my lab to William Lamb's site too. So you can read all about it there.
Nice.
One question I had on that. So the GPU that's breaking out to that external appliance, that's not like on a crossbar switch or anything. Those GPUs go one-to-one to nodes right now, correct?
Correct. Right now they do one-to-one. My goal is to set up, you know, maybe our Bitfusion technology.
Yeah, I was already thinking of Bitfusion and you building like a distributed GPU pool.
Yeah, and I got two more GPUs that NVIDIA just sent me, and they're the passive RTXs, so I get to play around with those. And I want to test them fully. You know, I want to do the vGPU. I always do the vGPU tests. I do the pass through, and I really want to play around with this Bitfusion stuff.
Nice. So, Johan, I also want to hear about your lab, and I want to hear why you have a lab in your house and what do you use it for? I know you're a consultant, so tell me a little bit about what your lab is and what you use it for.
Yeah, so 2 years ago, I wrote the VDI design guide, and I wanted to validate a lot of things that that are actually in the guide. And a lab is essential, or infrastructure in general is essential to validate stuff.
Yeah.
Just like when doing my VCDX, you need a lab to validate whatever is in the design. So again, for the book, it was essential. And since there's a big section on GPUs, I wanted to have space for some GPUs as well. And William just posted the build of materials for the E300AD, and that there was a vSAN configuration available based on that machine with 10 gigs, all flash. So I went for that machine at first, but it has a x8 PCI Express bus, which isn't fast enough to have a modern GPU in. So what I found was that there's a similar board with the same chipset, the exact same chipset, but the only thing that differs is that it has an X16 slot, which does fit a modern Tesla GPU from NVIDIA. So it's currently an all-flash vSAN-based environment. And I do a lot of GPU tests on it, also some machine learning stuff. And since a couple of weeks, I have Bitfusion running in my lab, and it works perfectly fine over 10 gigs.
Nice. See, that's the thing with home labs. You can't, it's, I can't imagine that you can do a one for one that you would see in a production environment. Yeah, you can see the proof of concept. You can see how these things work. But William, isn't there a major constraint like memory, for example? I know you struggled a little bit with some of the limitations on the Mac Mini due to memory. And then, of course, the Nooks themselves, you know, you can get, you know, memory in them. But is memory one of the biggest constraints? And is there a way to get around that? Or are there some other considerations?
Yeah, memory is still the kind of the main bottleneck for most people, especially on the smaller systems. The nice thing about this is if you look back about 12 to 18 months ago, you know, the Nooks kind of maxed out at 32 gigs of memory. When Apple released their 2018 Mac Minis, that was really the first platform that supported 64 gig SODIMM memory. These are primarily produced by Samsung. And I think it took some time for the industry to kind of get around higher memory capacity. And I actually got my hands on some of those SODIMMs right after Apple had released them. And I just decided to throw it into my Intel Nook 6th generation system. So this is like a six-year-old platform, basically. It's end of life already. And I was like, oh, let me just try this out and see if it will work. And funny enough, it actually did work. And so even for the Nooks, you can actually max them out for 64 gigs of memory. And the price has actually significantly gone down over the past year or so. So you're looking about $100 a stick for 32 gig DIMMs. So okay. To be able to double your memory capacity without necessarily buying a new kit, it has been really, really interesting for the community.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's only like $3 a gig. I mean, I remember paying like, you know, thinking 10 was cheap. And for a while there, you know, where we had some supply shortages, it was, you know, pushing up into the $20 a gig. So that's definitely going to make home labbing a lot more affordable.
Yeah. So if you have a couple of these Nooks, you know, 64 gigs of memory, it's starting to look pretty decent to be able to run a majority of the stack. I've seen a number of folks run NSX, even some vRealize and some operations, and maybe some PKS, depending on what you need. Now, if you really want to do a little bit more, having more complex topologies, yeah, you're going to probably need a little bit more memory. And I think that's where platforms like the Supermicro kits have been really, really popular. You know, these boxes can go anywhere from standard 64 gigs of memory all the way up to a quarter terabyte, half a terabyte of memory, actually, for the E300 kits. So there's definitely a little bit of wiggle room in that, and that's using standard DDR memory. So obviously the cost is going to be a little bit more prohibitive for some folks and all that, but you can certainly get some of these kits second market. And I think earlier we talked a little bit about cost. You know, one thing people tend to don't highlight as much is that, you know, we're always talking about buying net new kits, net new platforms every year.
Yeah.
There's some benefits to obviously the brand new CPUs and the platforms. But there's a lot of this enterprise gear that ends up landing on second, third party sites like eBay. And in fact, you can get a lot of this gear for almost 1/10 of the cost. And I know a lot of folks running it. Now, they may not be the most power efficient, but if you're really looking for biggest bang for your buck and having something that's a little bit more powerful processors and all that, there are definitely some options in the secondary market.
Yeah, but you do have to consider the spouse acceptability factor of the thermals are one thing, but also just the you know, the power bill, but also the noise on some of those. Like if you go get, you know, a stack of 3R710s or particularly even some of those 1U pizza boxes where they got those tiny little whiny fans, wee, you know, pushing a lot of air. You hopefully live in the north and have a basement and are in need of a heating plan in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah. No rack in the living room or bedroom, right? With the jet engine.
Yeah. I had a friend who he did that. He had a one bedroom apartment and had those in there, and like you'd be one room away and just hear it just roaring. And I think he had like an egg timer, so it would turn off at night before he went to bed. But
I actually replaced most of the fans in the standard kit by Noctua fans, like the silent ones. The only thing I couldn't replace is the fan in the Ubiquiti 10 gig switch. That's the only thing that actually makes a lot of noise, but it's in a silent rack, so it's pretty okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did the same thing. I replaced a lot of those whiny small fans with you know, consumer grade fans because they move air so much more efficiently and they're silent. They're dead silent.
Yeah, it's actually one of the best investments. They're not that expensive. In fact, I had my Supermicro kit sitting next to me, and every time I turn it on, I always think something's wrong. and I replaced the fan, and we just recently had like a small little brownout. And, you know, the lights are still blinking. So I was like, okay, it's, you know, it's still on. And I pressed it and I thought the system was broken. And I had to actually plug up my monitor and realize, no, it powered back on. And it's really night and day. And so if you have like a Supermicro kit, Noctura fans, like one of the best investments. I don't know why I waited so long. I just like one day I finally just went on Amazon, grabbed it. Super easy to install. Super worth it. Highly recommend it.
Nice. And Max, so you've got the Nooks in there, but you also have a really a sleek looking setup. Like you don't have a rack, you have some sort of casing for it that makes it look really cool. What is that?
Yeah, so it's a a buddy of mine, believe it or not, he's actually a woodworker, and he's got this great woodworking setup. He's a master woodworker. I had him, I create a bunch of stuff in plexiglass. I've had him do it, all the work, because to cut plexiglass, you have to have a really high speed saw, sharp blade, diamond tipped. And I don't have any of that stuff. You know, if I take my rotary saw to it, it just shatters and splinters into a billion pieces. So he's just mastered the art of creating plexiglass. So I had him create this little case that, because what I do is I don't just keep it in my office. I actually bring it out to, you know, V-Mug events, and just to show customers, hey, look, this is not, you know, production certified. It's not going to be supported by GSS, but this is VSAN right here in front of you. Wow. And the cool thing is, by showcasing it in that plexiglass, you can see everything that's going on, right? It's like, no, you know, I'm not hiding anything under my sleeves. This is it right here. So, you know, the nooks really look cool. And to not be able to see them, I think it's kind of a shame. So I just use it to just kind of keep the dust away from it and make it visible.
Nice. I like it. What V-Mugs are you going to so we can make sure to take a look at these?
Yeah. So I go to the Columbus, Ohio V-Mug, Cincinnati V-Mug. I've done a few speaking tours. I mean, I go to the Pittsburgh V-Mug. I don't know if they're having one this year, but there's I went to the Portland V-Mug as well, in Indianapolis. So being in the Midwest here, there's just a ton of V-Mugs and user cons mostly, but I'll do the chapter events too.
They'll fit in a suitcase as well, right?
Yes, it does. It fits really nicely in a rollaway.
Right. So you could just easily fly over to the UK or to the Dutch V-Mug as well, right?
We can arrange that, Johan. Definitely.
Awesome.
So, and I'm sure, William, I know you have a lot of experience in this, but do you have to tweak anything specific to vSAN if you're deploying vSAN in a smaller environment that's limited on resources? Are there any things that you need to do so you can still run vSAN with limited resources?
No, you used to have to tweak a couple of things. I think on the object reservation, it used to be not thin by default. I think those have actually changed in the most latest releases. On the nooks are really nice because they install perfectly fine. I think the most recent 10th generation Frost Cannon nooks, they had Intel had swapped out the NICs on them. So we needed to produce a special driver for that, which I have on my blog. But for the most part, they actually run really, really well. And, you know, like Max and John mentioned, you know, they travel very, very well, right? Just unplug them, very quiet, great for demo purposes and all that.
Yeah. And William, your site was helpful because, like you said, back in the day, you had to do all kinds of weird stuff, and you really helped a lot of these home labbers by creating those drivers for the NIC because you were kind of stuck. the default Intel NUC network card didn't work by out of the box. So, you know, thank you for everything that you're doing. But yeah, now it's so much easier. You know, just loading it even from scratch is so much easier.
Oh, yeah. And I think even on top of that, there's also a lot of options that you don't necessarily have these kind of options in the data center, or you may not need them because you can just go out and buy a 10 gig, 25 gig NIC and all that. But for the home labs, especially on the NUCs, since they have like a Thunderbolt 3 port on it, you know, we've got some work that we did with a Quanta, now Marvell, where you can get a fairly reasonable Thunderbolt to 10 gigabit NIC, right? And so if you have a couple of these boxes, you want to have 10 gigabits and not use your onboard NIC, right? Those are some options out there. We've seen some folks use both USB and Thunderbolt 3 connections and connecting that to an M.2 enclosure, right? And so there are tricks that you can actually use from a vSAN standpoint to actually be able to claim these disks that look like they're over USB, but the other side of the media is actually fairly highly reliable. And again, for lab purposes, this is probably sufficient if you need some more storage. Same goes for networking. Just like Max mentioned, we have this USB Fling that I worked on that allows a number of different NICs to be connected over USB. And those are still fairly reasonable ports, and you can connect them on your Supermicros or any other kit that has traditional USB ports. And so a lot of additional capabilities that you can even use these smaller form factors and add these additional layers of complexities that allows you to build out more interesting deployment models and stuff. And so that's the really interesting part that I love being involved in the community, seeing what kind of things are being innovated in the hardware space and enabling our technology to run on them smoothly.
So William, I know you're in your lab. The whole purpose of a lab is to check something out, make sure it works, break it, and then hopefully reset back to ground zero, you know, to a certain desired state, if you will. Like, what do you do for maintaining your lab? Do you like try something, blow it up, and then just start from scratch and have to rebuild everything? Something tells me the William Lamb that I know doesn't do everything manually, and there may be some automation to that. So are you using Veeam to back your stuff stuff up and then restore? Do you do any, you know, automation in terms of deployment? What is your plan to get you back to desired state after you've done some testing?
Oh, Pete, you know me so well.
I do.
if I did do any backups, I'd be running this little backup script called Ghetto VCB. but funny enough, I actually don't do backups. So I'm probably not the ideal candidate to follow. But I do a lot of automation. You're right. I do all sorts of testing. In fact, this week I'm doing some project specific stuff. And a lot of times I'm having to just deploy environments out. I don't like to repeat things, you know, using the UI or anything like that. So I tend to automate a lot of my things. I also run a lot of nested environments that allows me to easily replicate a particular configuration, whether it's vSAN, NSX, PKS. And so for me, leveraging a lot of the automation to be able to deploy nested into this home lab, I have a lot more control over it. If I break something, it doesn't break my physical setup. So I try to manage my physical infrastructure fairly generic, just like everybody else, apply the latest patches and all that. But for the workloads themselves, that's where I can get very creative and deploy all sorts of configurations. And for those ones, I deploy it when I need it. And then when I don't, I just go ahead and destroy it. So I have that resources for other workloads.
Nice. What about you guys? Johan, anything?
Well, yeah, I run Veeam to create backups towards an external Synology NAS. But yeah, rebuilding Horizon isn't that good in automatically building it necessarily. So I do a lot of manual stuff. But I do, like, if I want to provision stuff, things like a Windows 10 desktop or a couple of desktops, I do use the automation features in Horizon.
Okay.
And some provisioning with VRA. So I got a couple of workflows and blueprints in my vRealize instances and use that to distribute or to provision some VMs as well if I want to test something. And that works pretty well.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, if we're talking about upgrading lifecycle management, that was one of the actual reasons why I chose to go for a vSAN home lab, because I'm currently using the integrated update manager to update everything. But also, for instance, if NVIDIA or publishes a new version of vGPU, I can easily update the whole lab without any downtime of my production VMs.
Yeah.
And everything works automated and perfectly fine. So that was one of the main reasons going for a vSAN based lab.
That makes sense.
So one of the challenges I ran into with my Nook Lab was the generation of Nook I had didn't have the out-of-band management capability. I'm curious what you guys are doing for dealing with keyboard, you know, video and mouse. Do you have a switcher? Are you using an out-of-band, like an IPKVM type setup? Are you using, you know, someone figured out Redfish, RESTful, Bare Metal? You know, what are y'all doing for that?
Yeah, so yeah, this what I use. I found out early on that the Nooks, if you don't have like the HDMI plugged into them, after the fact, if it boots up without HDMI, it's like you can never get the thing to, even if you plug it in after the fact. It was kind of a pain. So when you have four Nooks running vSAN, you're kind of flying blind. So I got a IoGear 4-port HDMI KVM. And the only downside is it has a big bunch of cables, right? Because it's made to, you know, go a certain distance, and I only need it to go 2 inches. So I've just bundled them up really tight, but it's decent in the respect that I can have, you know, basically it maintains that persistent HDMI KVM connection so that the Nook is happy. And if I do want to plug in a monitor to it, I can just plug one in, hit a little button, and it goes right there. So it's manual.
Did you look at, there is this thing out there that is basically, it's an HDMI like loopback that pretends to be a real monitor. It's this little like thing you just jam into an HDMI port for systems that demand an HDMI for boot. I don't know if it's still out there. I remember looking at this.
Now I find out. So I could have probably saved me $150 bucks, you're saying. Thanks. Perfect.
So
No, I didn't find that clearly.
Nice. Well, man, William, I'm still looking at this list here, and it's amazing to me. I'm seeing a lot of some very familiar names, right? Eric Buznik, who's got an intense lab. You know, there's a lot of folks on here. Tinker Try from Paul Brerin. I mean, he is a lab aficionado for sure, and I know he even takes his on the road as well VMUGs. So a lot of good names out there. I love the fact that you started this effort because they all submitted like a blog post and explained their entire lab. So I'm sure this makes your life easier. easier, so you don't have to answer as many questions. But at the same time, man, this is a really great aggregated list. I'm going to have to really chew on this for a while.
Yeah, no, a lot of people actually, found a reason to actually blog about their environment. You know, they've been sharing it over social media. They haven't spent time writing about it. So I think that also gave them an opportunity to blog about some of their recent activities and stuff. You know, interestingly, the average cost was also a pretty interesting number that calculated. You know, we talked about mins and max earlier in the show. You know, on average, it looks like folks are spending roughly about $12,000, give or take, almost $13,000on lab setups. And I think that probably is roughly in line with some of the gear that folks are looking into, especially if you're looking at additional things like switches and upgrading relatively new hardware. But like I said, you can get started as quickly as $800 and you can go all the way up to, you know, a couple hundred grand.
Wow. Yeah. I feel like, there's several on here that I think are, you know, reasonable. Like, there's a guy named here, Trent Tassell, you know, he's $1,200, right? He's got, you know, ESXi, he's got vCenter, he's got a couple of nodes, you know, he's got a moderate setup where he can actually, he's got several workloads that he's running on it that he can test. And so I think that seems very modest, you know, a couple of grand to me. I don't know why. I'm not the aficionado on this, but I just feel like a couple of grand, you could probably do a lot of testing with, you know. Again, it really does depend on what you're testing. I know guys, you know, Johan's doing crazy stuff, you know, and he's doing stuff with GPU and he's doing, you know, artificial intelligence and like he's doing huge VDI deployments. And so, yeah, I could imagine, that he's spending a little bit more money than the average bear.
Right. Well, yeah. And power consumption has a wife acceptance, a certain wife acceptance factor as well. My previous lab had multiple GPUs and, you know, used more power. A single machine used more power than the three single nodes I have right now with the GPUs inserted. So that was one of the main goals for going for a less power consumption.
I like
and
it.
Ending up with a lab like this.
Yeah, getting started doesn't have to be super expensive. And the nice thing about this is that it can be an iterative thing. Right, you can get started for something as cheap as under $1,000 and have a fairly decent setup that can run a number of our products. And as you get more comfortable and based on the use cases that you're looking at, you know, maybe it helps you at your work and now you're able to get a raise. You're able to maybe get some training costs and maybe you can apply that training rather instead of a physical class. I've seen some people at VMware actually do that. Take their take two or take three and actually replace that with some hardware that they can actually invest in. And again, the nice thing about this, because you're running things like vSAN, very easy to grow that cluster and automatically have additional compute and storage capacity. And so you don't need to go all out and start out with the home lab. And in fact, even for my setup, it's one node. So if it goes away, it goes away. But it's something that you can easily expand over time as well, too. Really important to think about.
Well, I like that comment about for even when you're doing some training or workshops at work, you can still use that lab. Because I remember when I was doing my, back in the dark ages, my VCP class. And I was like, you know what? Instead of building this in the hosted lab that I won't have access to after this class is over, I actually VPN'd and logged into my work lab that I had a full vSAN cluster on. And I was building out a Horizon cluster and I built it there. And then when I was done, I was able to keep using that lab and show people and show customers and show people like what was going on with it. So I know sometimes people, when they do classes, they, you know, sometimes they'll be like, oh, this class is slower than my home lab or something like that. Well, you know, go build out a persistent environment there.
Yeah. I think one thing we can all agree is that there really is no substitute for having stick time. I mean, you can read all the documents, you can watch all the videos, you can read all the blog posts, but unless you're actually doing it yourself, there really is no substitute.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a lot of times the bandwidth has been a limitation to be able to get to your home labs, but it's gotten so much better these days that I can actually remote into my home lab and actually have instant access. And
yeah,
being able to do demos or, you know, just confirming something, like if a customer's having a problem and I just want to be able to answer something, I can remote right into my home lab pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Could you also remote and play like your famous race game?
Racing? I don't know. Not. I don't have like Phi Optics. A lot of people have gig internet to their house. It's like they haven't quite made it to me yet. I've got like 100 megabit, but someday I think we need to do that. We need to actually say you can run this on home internet.
Yeah, that's
nice. We should collaborate there.
Yeah, definitely.
Beautiful. All right. Well, so if you have a home lab, hopefully you've documented it on the aggregated list that's on William's GitHub. I'm going to leave a link to that on the show notes of this page for sure. The short link is vmwa.re/homelab. So VMware/homelab. And yeah, again, but I will be leaving links to that. So if you're not on that list, please be on that list. And if you don't have a home lab, you need to check this list out, because you can see the range is very impressive. And not only is it just a list of who's doing what, but it actually has really, really informative accompanying blog posts for every one of these. So this is really exciting. I think this is a great contribution to the IT community. William, thanks for aggregating that. Max, thank you for joining. Johan, thanks for joining. Anybody, anything before we take off and land this plane?
Thanks for letting me be on the show. This is I had no idea just submitting that little tweet of my home lab was going to get me on your show. I've been listening for a long time. Thanks, guys.
Oh, thanks, Matt. And thanks for the lab, man. That was impressive. Good stuff. John, anything else before we let these gentlemen go?
No, I need to get some cooler lights for my lab and my gear. That's what I learned right now. So I'm just watching those blinking in the back end, and I'm just completely mesmerized.
You know, VSAN has, you know, this is one thing I've thought about, never done. So this is a challenge for whoever wants to play with it. So VSAN has the ability to basically flicker the LEDs on some disk. And I was talking to Duncan about this a while back ago. I was like, it'd be really cool to have some music play along in a data center. And there's APIs for this, actually. And just imagine turning the lights off, playing some music, and just having some lights that just goes with that. That'd be fantastic. Just scare somebody or whatever.
This sounds like a feature that I could have seen Chad Sakich creating. Like this sounds like a Chad Sakich music video waiting to happen.
Right when I saw those APIs. Awesome. When I saw those APIs, I was like, come on, somebody's got to do something. And I'm actually surprised nobody's actually done anything with that yet. So
I'll take a look at those APIs. You can use this if you want, Pete and John, but I actually had a Nook fail at one point. And when they replaced it with the 8th generation Nook, which does not have the little ring LEDs.
Oh.
And I was like, I was so disappointed. What I actually did was I went to eBay and I bought a bare bones Nook just to replace it. So I have four that have the actual blinking LEDs, because they're actually kind of cool.
Oh yeah.
And you have to buy like the i7 version now, and it makes it ridiculously expensive. So I actually have a 8th generation Nook here that I don't do anything with because of the lights, sadly.
that's intense right there. OCD much? I like it.
Not quite recently, there was a guy who had like a E300 AD and replaced the front with the Gavin Belson Signature Edition Box 3 logo, including the whole lighting of the LED, and it was seriously awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, that's one of the home lab goals for 2020, I guess.
Hashtag pimp
your
lab.
We have another episode, Pete, on best how to pimp my home lab.
Exactly, pimp my lab.
Yeah, we'll have Exhibit, you know, as the host of it. You know, yeah, I like it. I think we have something here. We have a future episode. Good stuff. All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this in all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to my friend William, Johan, and Max for joining us this week. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.